First of all, I wanna say Alhamdulillah, God give me everything. Alhamdulillah, I know you got this, you don't like this. Alhamdulillah.
Rebel out of me. Gotta thank God for my team. Hop in the mail like Alhamdulillah. Counters the nail like Alhamdulillah. Check my apparel like Alhamdulillah. Fly the spell like Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah. Like Alhamdulillah, sharp as an arrow. Like Alhamdulillah, turn me to a star. Got me a new car. He got me this fall. Alhamdulillah, he gave me something to rap about. Forget the trap route. Look at the devil we tapping now. I ain't backing now. Musala's arenas I'm packing now. Like Pacquiao, but I ain't going down. Muslims I'm holding down. Alhamdulillah, 'cause he hold a crown. The Shadiyaki, you know the sound. Master the talk, why you know the town? I am.
It is Tuesday, March the 12th, and this is the MMA Scene Podcast. I'm your host, Idris Crawley, writer for MMASucker.com and WMMARankings.com. Every once in a while for the Combat Docket as well. Before we get started with today's show, I know some of you have seen the new logo for the blog on Facebook and the new logo for the podcast as well. That logo was created by our newest sponsor, that being Shansi Design. So if you're looking for a logo for your podcast, for your brand, or you just want something cool to put on a shirt, and head on over to Shansi Designs for all that kind of stuff. And let them know that I sent you, and they'll give you a nice little discount as well. It's been, a little over a week since the UFC 235 event, and I don't talk necessarily too much about UFC events because everybody does that these days. But it was an interesting event when you look at the five... To me, the five most interesting bouts on the card, that being Zibit Magomedsharipov versus Jeremy Stephens. You had Weili Zhang taking on Tisha Torres. You had the debut of Ben Askren against former champ Robbie Lawler. And then you had the welterweight title fight between Tyron Woodley and Kamaru Usman. I hate when people call that man Tyrone, by the way. And then the main event for the light heavyweight title between John Jones and Anthony Smith. The John Jones fight was interesting because a lot of people were giving heat to John Jones for his performance. I think it was a masterful performance. I think he didn't want to go in there and not overcommit, but be too aggressive and get caught by someone like Anthony Smith. Because when you're in these fights where you're expected to not only perform well, not only be victorious, and not only be dominant, but finish your opponent fairly easily, it's easy to get caught up, and it's easy for people's expectations to be low when you have a performance like the one that John Jones had. But he dominated every aspect of the fight, and it's similar to the Overeem St. Preux fight, but not really. And people were speculating as to why John Jones performed in the way that he did, you know, blowing out guys like Daniel Cormier and Alexander Gustafsson most recently. But I also think going into this fight, this is one of the fights where a lot of eyes were on him. This is probably the most he's ever been tested. The controversy surrounding his picograms and things of that nature brought a lot more attention to him than he probably would have liked. And I don't know if it impacted his performance or not. But he's still the champion. He beat a guy who probably should not have been in there, but what a heart from Anthony Smith, especially when he got caught with that knee, that illegal strike, when he was on the ground or whatever, to not just take that title fight and the millions of dollars that comes with it and walk away. Takes a lot of character, and I've seen a lot of people criticizing for that, like, why would you do that when you're leaving so much money on the table? You got an immediate rematch with John Jones. You know what to expect in the next fight. Maybe you could do a little better or whatever. But that's people who really don't have a lot of character, to be honest with you. He definitely has the heart of a lion, and he's going to be better for this fight because he took a lot of what John Jones had to offer with the jumping kicks to the knees, spinning elbows, the takedown, the ground and pound, and all that stuff. I mean, like him or not, you have to respect the fact that John Jones is one of the best fighters to ever compete in this sport. And Anthony Smith is one of few people that lasted five rounds with him. So you got to give that man credit for that. And I'm sure he's going to be favored in just about every other fight outside of John Jones and Daniel Cormier right now because he was able to survive for five rounds alone. But, you know, and for good reason, really, that when people talk about the UFC 235 event, they don't really talk about the main event, really. A lot of the eyes were on the welterweight title fight and, well, the welterweight division because you had two very important fights in the welterweight division take place on the same card. And I don't know anyone that expected Kamaru Usman to dominate Tyron Woodley in the way that he did, getting 10-8 rounds and all. I mean, where did Tyron Woodley look good? Where did he get anything off to make you think he was ever in that fight? Kamaru Usman is a complete beast, and he gets a lot of hate, I think, not just for his style, and he has a good style. It's not the most aesthetically pleasing if you're someone who doesn't understand or appreciate high-level wrestling or high-level grappling. But he gets a lot of hate because of his manager, Ali Abdelaziz, as if Ali is the only horrible manager out there. I mean, come on now. This sport is filled with horrible individuals. We have to be real about it. But that should not be, that hate for Ali should not be transferred onto his fighters. Kamaru Usman really, you know, he's currently the undisputed UFC welterweight champion or whatever, but he put it on Tyron Woodley, who is one of the top welterweights in the history of the sport. And I'm a big fan of Tyron. One of the reasons is because when I first started this show, he was one of the first fighters to grant me an interview, one of the more high-profile guys to take time out of their schedule to allow me to interview them and tell their story or whatever. So I really appreciate Tyron Woodley. He's done a lot from the sport. He's come a long way since his Strikeforce Challengers days. I remember Pat Miletich used to say in Strikeforce that this guy is a beast. He's going to be UFC champion one day, and these guys, you know, they're going to have to watch out for this guy. And everyone basically laughed him out the building. No one really believed it, but what an eye did that man have, because Tyron Woodley has gone from being just up-and-coming guy on the Strikeforce Challenger series to a former Strikeforce and UFC welterweight champion, and to be considered one of the best welterweights in the world. But Kamaru Usman now has challengers lining up for him now. Of course, you have Colby Covington, and Dana White said that that's the next fight to make, who's the former interim champion. He's the former interim champion because the UFC stripped him of the title, not because he was defeated for the title. And it's an interesting matchup, but I think it's a matchup in where you have two guys with similar styles, and one just seems to be a few steps ahead. What I mean by that is not just in the technical ability, technical aspect of the game, but also athleticism. Usman is a more athletic, more powerful, faster version of Colby Covington. So, in my view, Colby Covington will be trying to wrestle the title away from a better version of himself. So that's a fight that's very interesting to see, but it's not too appealing. You know, it's like, yeah, I'll watch that fight, but it's not like I have to see the fight. You know what I mean? And also, Ben Askren is trying to make moves toward the title as well. He said that he would only challenge for the title if he got Tyron Woodley's blessing. These guys have been friends since their time in collegiate wrestling. But what can you say about Ben Askren, man? I mean, he's 19-0 now. You gotta give the man his credit. You gotta give him his props. Former Bellator champion, former ONE champion, comes over to the UFC and wins in the most Ben Askren way possible. And what I mean by that is he got suplexed on his head within the first few seconds of the fight and is taking shot after shot from Robbie Lawler. And then he finds a way to get back to his feet, still taking shots. And the most hilarious thing about the fight to me is while Ben Askren is eating shots from former UFC welterweight champion Robbie Lawler, you hear Joe Rogan say, and this was always the question, could he do this to UFC caliber fighters? Could he do what he was able to do to other guys? He was able to do this. He was able to beat up on Douglas Lima, former Bellator welterweight champion. He was able to beat up on Andrei Korshkov. But would he be able to do that to guys in the UFC? And then like 30 seconds later or so, the fight's over because Ben Askren catches Robbie Lawler in a submission. And the submission itself, you know, the first time I ever saw a bulldog choke was when Carlos Newton choked out Pat Miletich. I believe it was at UFC 31, I'm not sure, for the welterweight title. And the second time I saw it was when I believe it was Raquel Pennington who caught Ashley Evan Smith in a bulldog choke. I'm not sure, but I think that's what happened. I think she was losing the fight, and in a scramble, she caught her in a bulldog choke, and the fight was over. But it's a great submission, and of course, by now, you all know I'm visually impaired, so some of the details I miss, I can see a lot of the action, but some of the real small details I miss. But Henner and Heron Gracie from the Gracie Breakdown and Gracie University, they released a Gracie Breakdown about a day or two later and explaining why the submission was in, why it was still locked in, and why Robbie Lawler would eventually succumb to it. I can't give you any kind of opinion on that because, again, I didn't see where the chin was facing and all this other stuff. But I will say that Ben Askren went on, I believe it was the Ariel Helwani show. Is that what he calls it now on ESPN? No longer the MMA Hour, which sucks now without him. Although I recognize the talent that Luke has with his Monday morning analysts and some of the questions he asks and the approach he has with the sport and blah, 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 blah. But he went on Ariel's show, I believe that's the show it was, and he said, yeah, people think he wasn't out, but like he was basically out. When his hand dropped, it didn't drop in a way that would make you think that he was trying to brace himself or put weight on it or anything. It dropped with the palm facing up, which would suggest that he was out. I mean, who drops their hand on the floor with the palm facing up for any reason, really? You know, so it was a very interesting comment. I don't know how true it is. Again, I missed that detail. But Herb got a lot of heat for it. I think it's easy to give these guys heat in the moment. I know a lot of people thought he was out briefly right when it happened. But Robbie Lawler's clash, man. He told Herb right after the fight that, like, he's still, like, a great ref. I'm not going to use the language he used, but he's still one of the best refs out there, and that's something I agree with. I'm a big fan of Herb Dean as a ref. Yeah, it was controversial. Ben Askren had another controversial submission in Bellator back in the day as well. But he won, man. He'd be a former UFC welterweight champion, and like he said on the mic afterwards, who's next? Is that all you got, Dana, is what he said, really. And who is next for Ben Askren? He said he wouldn't take that title shot unless he got the blessings of Tyron Woodley, like I said. And I think what's next for him really is a fight with someone like Rafael Dos Anjos or maybe Darren Till if he wins, which is a fight that, you know, it's the classic striker versus grappler. But considering how Till performed against Tyron Woodley, by that I mean not at all, I think it's a good matchup for Ben Askren. It's a good way for him to look good in front of UFC fans as well, get another win. And after that, they'll probably push him to the title or something. Maybe someone like Darren Till or Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, someone along those lines. But he's right there now, man. You got to give him his credit. People who are hating on him, you can't really hate on him anymore, man. He did his thing, and he actually made me a fan, man. I've been watching him for a while, ever since he won the Bellator tournament. He beat up on my guy, Andrei Korshkov, broke him mentally, it looked like. Beat up on my guy, former MFC champion Douglas Lima. Went over to Ryan, did his thing. Now he finally made it to the UFC after all this time, and congratulations to him, man. For sure. All right, I'm going to take this break, and I'll be back on the other side and talk about the fight that actually made me purchase that pay-per-view. Be right back.
Are you looking for a good fight? Check out the Fight pay-per-view schedule. Watch on the biggest screen in the house. What's the fight tonight? MMA, boxing, pro wrestling, live on pay-per-view. Just tap play and pick a screen to watch on. Playback shifts instantly to the screen of your choice. No hardware, no hassle. Download the Fight app and start watching today.
So what fight made me buy UFC 235? Because I don't get every pay-per-view, to be honest with you. Well, that fight was the strawweight women's fight between Weili Zhang and Tisha Torres. And the reason for that is because both of them are, Tisha Torres used to be one of my favorite fighters early on in her career. But Weili Zhang has been my favorite women's fighter for, I guess, a little over 2 years now. I started following her on the regional scene in China, became a fan of her style. I love the Sanda approach to striking. She's aggressive on the ground, well-rounded. She has like an aggression that you really don't see on the women's scene much at all. And I just love the way that she fights. If you've listened to this show for a while, then you've heard me talk about Weili Zhang before she came over to the UFC. And I think her team did a wonderful job in bringing her up, in the sense that when she was coming up on the regional scene, she lost the first fight of her career, but then she took fights to build her up, to build her confidence up. And then they would challenge her here and there. They'd challenge her with a Svetlana Gadasik. They'd challenge her with a Emmy Fujino. They'd challenge her with a Marilia Santos. They'd challenge her with a Simone Duarte, who's 8-1 now, her only defeat coming to the hands of Zhang. They challenge her with the Sadomeya sisters, who aren't really the best fighters out there, but they're not an easy out for anyone. And I just think her career has been managed correctly. And then you look at Tisha Torres. Tisha Torres never really lived up to her potential, but she's still a solid fighter. I believe this is her third loss in a row. I could be wrong on that, but she has had to lose three of her last four. But who's she losing to? She's losing to the best of the best. She's losing to the Joanna Jędrzejczyk. She's losing to the Jessica Andrade. She's losing to now the Weili Zhangs. That says a lot about Zhang to be able to defeat someone like Tisha Torres. And, you know, Why didn't Tisha Torres live up to her potential? Well, I talked to her early on in her career. She was 7-0 on the regional scene. As an amateur, she captured three titles on the amateur circuit and crossed over to the pro ranks. She faced Rose Namajunas early on, very good fight, and Invicta. You should check that out on Fight Pass. And Rose eventually got that one back in the UFC, but they were two of the top prospects on the women's scene when they fought. I believe they both had like three professional fights to their name at that point, or something along those lines. But early on in her career, she had some major managerial issues. She was not happy with her management, how they've been handling her, how they were treating her, and things like that. And she eventually changed, but I don't think she recovered. That's a lot for a young fighter especially a young female fighter, to deal with early on in their career. I don't think she really recovered. I think she lost some of her passion for the sport. And she made some bad moves, moving away from American Top Team. She's back now. Like, alhamdulillah, she's back. Best move for her, in my opinion. And, you know, someone who spoke at length about managing fighters and analyzing the abilities of fighters and things like that is Shawn Humes at the Black Jordan Brain on Twitter. I leave that kind of stuff up to him because he can see a lot of the small details and everything in the striking and blah, blah, blah. Even though I have a background in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, again, I miss some of the small details. My vision doesn't always catch everything. So I leave that to someone like him. And I think he's the best in the business in doing that. And these people really need to hire him on board to give direction to these teams, these corners, these fighters, and so on. But Tisha Torres never really lived up to her potential, but she's still one of the top fighters out there. And now that she's back in American Top Team, if she stays with it, I think she'll be fine and will break that top 10 once again. I think I have her on at 14 at strawweight on my rankings, which you can check out on Facebook at MMA Scene Blog. Not the, just MMA Scene, S-C-E-N-E, blog. But the fight with Willie Zhang, it was a good fight. I enjoyed it. Some people didn't, but I did. And Whaley was getting some criticism for not being able to finish the fight. You know, people have been accustomed to, or they see her record and be like, oh, 7 submissions, 9 TKOs, so 16 of her finishes have been stoppages. So why is she not finishing all these women in the UFC like she was doing on the regional scene in China? Well, I'll tell you the reason for that. Her second fight in the UFC was against Jessica Aguilar, former WSOF champ. She was a contender in the Bellator strawweight champ tournament back in the day. I believe that was 2010, 2011, around there. Experienced BJJ brown belt. She came in there, slammed her to the canvas. Talking about Zhang, slammed Aguilar to the canvas, cut her open with elbows, moved to mount, jumped into the triangle, switched to the armbar, and finished her. Completely dominating performance. But why was it so dominating? Why was she so aggressive? Why was she able to do to Aguilar what she wasn't able to do to Taylor and Torres? Well, the reason for that is because it was in China. It was in her home country, and her striking coach was there. The two fights she's had in the U.S., her striking coach wasn't able to get the visa approved and come over here to corner her. And she spoke about that after the fight with Daniel Taylor, that it really affected her mentally to not be able to look around and see her coach or hear her coach. It affected her approach. So she took a similar approach, somewhat similar to what John Jones did in the Smith fight, in the sense that she stayed in her comfort zone. She was able to sit back and pick apart both Taylor and Torres. And she was, it's not to say that she wasn't aggressive. She was aggressive, but not nearly as aggressive, not nearly as confident as she was when she competes in China with her coach behind her. So that's something that they need to really take into consideration if the UFC is hoping, you know, with the announcement of the Performance Institute in China actually being 3 times bigger than the one in Vegas. If they really want a Chinese champion, then her next fight needs to be in China for her to be able to perform at her best and put on a show or whatever until they get these visa issues with her coach taken care of. She performs her best with her coach, and then China. She's the most aggressive fighter on the women's scene when she's in that environment. And no, Jay Griggs from BJPenn.com and TheBodyLockMMA.com, very knowledgeable guy on WMMA. He was saying he doesn't think that the location matters. But I think the location did matter. It wasn't just the location. It was the her coach not being there, and it affected her. And she spoke on this. It does affect her. It does affect her. And you can see it in her performance. You can see it in her approach the entire game of mixed martial arts. She didn't even like try to take the fight with Torres down to the ground too often or whatever. She just, you know, coming from that Sanda background, and I love Sanda, she stayed in her comfort zone and felt comfortable with the way the fight was going on the feet, and she just kept it there so she could win a solid decision. Biggest win of her career by far. And you should check out my interview with Weili Zhang in the lead up to the fight. She actually granted me the interview while she was in the final preparations for the fight. The same week, fight week, she gave me the interview for MMAsucker.com. You should check that out. But staying with strawweight, and I'm really happy for Weili Zhang. She's 3-0 in the UFC now, 19-1 overall. She's definitely a fighter to keep an eye on. But before we move on to Invicta, who should she fight next? Well, I thought the fight that made the most sense was Nina Ansarov. I think she's better than Nina in every aspect of MMA: physicality, technique, striking, grappling, aggressiveness, what have you. That'd be a good win for her. But Ansarov is scheduled to take on Tatiana Suarez, and the winner of that is definitely the number one contender and will face the winner of Andrade Namajunas, for sure. I don't see why not. Another interesting opponent, potential opponent for Zhang is Carla Esparza, former champion, has a good wrestling base, would pose some interesting challenges to Zhang. That would be an interesting fight too. But I think the fight that makes the most sense is the winner between Michelle Waterson and Karolina Kowalkiewicz. And the reason for that, especially Michelle Waterson, because she's athletic, she's a good striker. You know, she'll challenge Zhang on the feet a little bit. But I think she's a little too small for strawweight, a little too small for Zhang. Zhang's a physical fighter. You know, she likes to impose her will. She likes to be aggressive. She likes for you to fight on your back foot. She likes to come forward. But Waterson really belongs at Adam weight, but you know, she's had some tough cuts in the past to 105, to the point where her pulse like dropped to a level she wasn't really happy with or whatever, and hasn't gone back down since. And you know, I'm one of those people who say, like, if the cut affects you in a negative way, health wise, then you should stay away from it. So if she's going to be a small straw weight for the rest of her career, I'm perfectly fine with that, if it's the healthy decision for her as a fighter. So I would love to see Zhang opposite Waterson sometime this year, and then maybe get a title shot by year's end. You know, we could realistically see Suarez take on Zhang for the title later this year. You never know what can happen. But moving on to the Invicta recently announced that they will be holding a one-night, eight-woman tournament in the strawweight division in May, part of their new Phoenix Rising series. It'll be featuring Janessa Miranda and Mizuki Inoue. I'm interviewing both fighters for the event as well. Former UFC competitor Juliana Lima and a few other women I can't really think of off the top of my head now. Daniel Taylor, I think, is in there as well. But I just don't think it makes sense. You know, it makes sense if all of the champions are going to be pushed to other organizations. Because when you crown a tournament champion, and I love the one-night tournament format, it'll be good for these women to showcase their skills and get experience. Three fights in one night, that's like a whole year's worth of experience. But crowning a tournament champion when you already have an undisputed champion, for this case, in the form of Verna Jandiroba, crowning a tournament champion in the strawweight division is nothing more than crowning a glorified interim champion. It doesn't really make much sense. So, okay, you can say that the winner will be guaranteed a shot at Jandiroba, but Jandiroba shouldn't be in Invicta. You know, she's 14-0 now. She's done everything she needs to. She already has a win over Miranda and over Inoue. She needs to be pushed to the UFC. Yeah, Felicia Spencer, the former now Invicta featherweight champion, going to the UFC. You have Sarah Kaufman, former bantamweight champion now going over to the PFL. I think if you're going to do this tournament format for each division, which Shannon Knapp said, you need to push Porto to the UFC. You need to push Jandaroba to the UFC. And the winner of these tournaments should be considered the undisputed Invicta champion of each division. Adam Wade is the only one you can realistically have a tournament and have the winner face the champion, because no other major organization is fully dedicated to the Adam Wade division. What I mean by fully dedicated, I mean you have Bellator, who just signed Lindsey Van Zandt. She's had a fight for them at Adam Wade. You have Combate Americas, who holds fights in the Adam Wade division, but nobody's crowning champion. Nobody's picking up prospects. Nobody's showing that they're investing in 105 right now. So Adam Wade is really the only one you can, you know, it'll be fine. But this is a way for Invicta to change it up, to keep things fresh, to keep interest in the organization. It's a marketing tool. I get it. And I like it, but I just think it makes more sense if the winner is crowned champion and not glorify interim tournament champion. And two fights were announced for the UFC 238 card in the women's division. I just mentioned the Suarez Ansarov fight, but also on that card will be Kaitlyn Trukagin taking on Joanne Calderwood, which is a very interesting fight. If you look at the resumes of all of the women who are tied for the most wins in flyweight, which is three, because the division is so new. You look at the top two of those women, and you have Jessica Ai, who's fighting for the flyweight title against Valentina Shevchenko shortly. And then you have Joanne Calderwood. And if you compare their two resumes, Calderwood is the one that should be getting the title shot. I mean, the common opponent they have is Kalindra Feria, where Ai probably should have lost that fight, and Calderwood stopped Ferrier. So, but we got some really good fights coming up in the future as well. And you know, one thing I didn't mention about that 235 card is Zabit Magomedsharipov defeating Jeremy Stephens. A really good win for him. Maybe not as dominant as they would have liked, but a very good win for him. And with Max Holloway facing Dustin Poirier for the interim lightweight title, winner will be facing Khabib Nurmagomedov probably somewhere near the end of the year, in November or something like that. You're going to see. Now they're talking about booking Magomedsharipov against Brian Ortega. And it was just recently announced that Jose Aldo will be taking on Alex Volkanovski. We can realistically see the winner of these two fights collide later this year for the undisputed featherweight title, because Max Holloway has had trouble making 145 in the past, like very secretive health issues and just so many things surrounding it. And he said himself that he's tired of cutting to 145 and may move to lightweight. And him stepping up and trying to make the Khabib fight at 223, but eventually had to pull out last second, and because the commission stopped him from cutting. And now for the interim title, it's clear that his goal is to kind of gain some kind of stability at lightweight so he doesn't have to cut those 10 extra pounds to featherweight. And I'm all for that, man. I'm all for the health of the fighter, you know, where you can perform at your best, at the best health is where you need to be. I mean, you look at what Brave is doing over there and implementing the super lightweight division with Manir Laziz, who I interviewed for MMA Sucker recently, taking on Eldarov. They have a combined 17-1 record, with the only loss on Eldarov's record being at the hands of Khabib Nurmagomedov. And Laziz is 7-0, and he's just a beast coming down from welterweight to 165. I really enjoyed the interview with him. You guys should check that out. But they're implementing this and moving welterweight up to super welterweight, which is 175, and already crowned the Jordanian Lion, Jarrell Salawi, as the super welterweight champion. They're doing it for the health of the fighters, and I think it's a great move, and it's good to see that a major mixed martial arts organization is dedicated to that kind of approach to the business and the sport of mixed martial arts. What I don't like is them calling it super welterweight when you don't have a welterweight division anymore. So what's super about it, you know? It should just be labeled as welterweight. I understand under the unified rules, you have to call it super welterweight, but we just need to like adjust these divisions, man. They all need to be separated by 10 pounds. I mean, you should have a 195 division if you have the means to house that many fighters, that many athletes. I don't know if they would call it super middleweight or something like that. I'm not sure what they would call something like that in boxing or whatever, because I'm not a boxing guy, but I love these kind of moves, man. You have so many high quality fighters coming up all over the world, so many promotions rising up. You have ACA over in Russia, you have one in Asia, of course Rizin, Bellator, PFL's making some moves too, man. I'm not even going to discuss that lightweight tournament. I mean, the only thing I say about it is I'm glad that Sarah Kaufman's can potentially make 33 times what she would be making as a UFC fighter in one year. And I mean, her old UFC contract was seeing her make $22,000 a fight. If you look at Tania Avenger and Yana Kunis-Kaier, who were former Invicta bantamweight champions like her, they pay them each $100,000 to face Cyborg. And then in their very next fight, I think Kunis-Kaier was getting $25,000 and Avenger was getting $30,000 or the reverse or something along those lines, you know. So, you know, these women aren't really getting paid that well. And Kaufman has been in this sport for a long time, man. And the UFC wasn't interested in bringing her back in, even though she's like 20-4. She only has 4 losses in 24 fights. And they just signed Julia Avila. So, you know, I think she was being disrespected. I don't think she's gotten the respect she deserves as a high-level championship mixed martial artist by fans, media, and organizations as well. So it's good to see that she signed on with PFL. I really hope she wins the tournament, and I hope she gets that $1 million prize, man, because she's put in the work. She's been lobbying for fights. It just hasn't been coming for her. I think this is the perfect way for her to end her career. So I hope it goes well for her. But yeah, man, that's about it. That's about all I have for you today. Sorry this, you know, is so delayed or whatever, but I wanted to get this out for you guys. You can follow me on Twitter at Idrees Crawley, IDREESCRAWLEY. You can follow the blog on Facebook at MMA Scene Blog, and on Twitter as well at MMA Scene Blog. Head on over to WMMARankings.com. Check out my work for them. And also, most recently, for MMASucka.com. That's MMASUCKA.com. And most recently, I interviewed, and this is how I span the globe for you guys. You look at Willy Zhang, China, Manir Laziz, Tunisia, currently training at Team Noguera in Abu Dhabi. I have Elder Eldarov from Russia, from Dagestan. He's coming on. I'm going to be talking to him about the fight with Laziz as well. So I'm covering that whole fight from both sides. I'm talking to Janaysa Morandan and Mizuki Inoue about the Phoenix Rising series. Yeah, I've been all over the place, man. I recently spoke with Sean Santella, who's trying to get a fight with Brave after his return to CFFC, because he was scheduled to fight in Brave in December, but his opponent got injured. So, he Brave let him take a fight outside of the organization, which is good on them as well. But yeah, I got a lot of things planned for you guys, and hopefully I'll see you back here either later this week or early next week. I don't know. We'll see. You guys take care, man. Thanks for listening.